used in the conversation about LGBT people. It's not next chronologically. It's actually before the passage we talked about. But it's Genesis 19. So Genesis 19 is the Sodom and Gomorrah story. And so before I have any commentary at all, we're going to just start with our process. So remember the layers of context. As we try to understand a passage, you're always going to walk through these layers of context to get the full picture. And this time, for this story, because of the weight of the words, we're going to kind of do it backwards. We're going to start at the backpack and go in. So this passage, we are going to read it, but before we read it, I want to just talk about what's already in our backpack before we even look at the text. So this is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Without any further comment, what's in our backpack when this story comes up?
What do we think about it?
What have you learned about it? What do you think about it? What comes to mind? Basically, the idea of looking at our backpack is that when we read a passage of Scripture, we need to be aware of the fact that the things we already bring with us shape and color how we read it. So you've already heard things. You've already been taught things. The words have certain meanings to you already. And so before we read the Scripture, we just need to notice that stuff and how it might impact the way we read the text. Okay? Is that clear?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, so what's in the backpack?
Sodomy is a sexual act.
Okay, so first off, there's two things there. First off, we have a word. And that word finds its root in this passage. Okay, this is not just a word in English. It's a legal term. It's got long history and heritage. Sorry, this is Grandma who's about to pick up Lucas. Gotta take this one. Hello. Hi. Yeah, I did. I'm teaching class, and so I just left a voicemail for you with information about where Lucas is at, because I have a class from 9:30 to 10:30. Okay, so he's in my office. He knows where his bag is, and he's hanging out playing iPad, and whenever you get here, that's where he is. Cool. Thank you so much. Bye.
You don't know where Lucas is.
He's on 52nd Morrison,
right?
I think, on the corner.
Right. Okay, so we have a word, and that word is a sexual act.
Whenever this story is used or quoted or referenced, it's never in a positive light. It's always used to bring judgment of some kind or justify judgment.
And it's harsh.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just like a correction, a course correction. It's like
when we talk about fire and brimstone, this is actually the literal place in the Bible where there is fire and brimstone. This is the place. When you talk about Old Testament preachers and fire and brimstone preachers, this is where that comes from, right? So it's, yes, it's not just, hey, this is a bad thing. But the judgment is profound, traumatic destruction.
Universal. I mean, it's
complete. Right. Yeah. Where are Sodom and Gomorrah today?
Gone, though.
Right?
Yeah.
Gone. There's no trace. Full, no trace, eternal, fiery,
legal.
Does that bring any bells for you? Eternal fiery judgment.
And sodomy is not just a sexual act, but a perverse sexual act.
A series of them.
Okay, it's specific acts that are, we've all decided they're perverted sexual acts. Mm-hmm. They are specifically, I think, of the legal definitions. Male sexual acts. I don't think women can be convicted of sodomy.
Unless they're mimicking
but that's
a
like,
male sexual act.
Without
giving
right. Woo!
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, yes. So, anything else that's in the backpack?
Confusion, I think, actually, for me, because I realized that I really knew little about the story at all, other than like it's just bad, icky, da-da-da. And then I think I got a little, you know, positive for me, different information, but it all feels really just kind of foggy.
This is one of those stories that gets referred to a lot. It also gets referred to a lot in the Bible. We'll talk about that. But it isn't necessarily a story that everybody's intimately familiar with the whole details of.
Yeah, it feels almost like, well, you don't really need to know because you got this, and that's really all you need.
Right, yeah, don't do this thing.
Yeah, it's all
bad. And then you don't need to worry about the rest of the story. Okay. Okay, anything else? All right, so we're going to start working down. So where does this story, before we read it, where does this story fall in the overall biblical narrative? That's that umbrella picture. So where does it fall in the Bible?
Early.
Early in the Bible, yeah?
Early in the story.
So it's early. It's also...
I mean, you're
definitely Old Testament.
Yeah, you're a few chapters over from Abraham, so
okay.
It's at the very beginning.
Right, so this is not just early, it's the beginning.
Yeah.
Might be interesting to note that in the flow of Abraham's story, this is actually before the law is given.
Might be the reason the law was given.
What?
Might be the reason the law was given.
Okay. I meant Mount Sinai.
Oh.
Right.
Right, this is before... Israel comes out of Egypt, Mount Sinai, before that whole thing. So by that I mean pre-law means also pre-Israel.
Yeah.
There is no nation of Israel. There's just Abraham and his family. And at this point, it's not even a very big family. Pre-Ten Commandments, all that, right? So this is really, really, really early in the story. Anything about that that might be interesting or important for us to pay attention to as we read the text?
There's no specific guidelines of how to be people in community.
Okay, right. So there's no texts prior to this that say anything about sex acts to avoid. The only sex text before this is Genesis 1 and 2. Be fruitful and multiply. That's the only command about sex behavior that we have prior to this. Now, did God give them instructions? We don't know. Maybe God gave them instructions. Maybe there were some other instructions that they had. But it's not in the Bible. There's no record. There's no recording of those passages, of those instructions given. So really, all we're left with is to assume that Abraham and his family have whatever is common ethical knowledge.
Primitive, yeah.
Primitive to their culture, common to their shared religions, and whatever revelation God's given them, but that hasn't been recorded in Scripture. So they don't have, like even what we read last week, right, when we were spending our time in Leviticus, they don't have that. None of that has been laid out yet. Okay, so that's important, I think, contextually to think about, you know, where we're going with the passage. Anything else that occurs to you about where the story falls in the biblical narrative? It's definitely an Old Covenant thing, if we're going to make the Old Covenant, New Covenant distinction. It's definitely Old Covenant. Anything that happens pre-Israel, you know, I mean, if you're going to do the substitutionary thing, the church is Israel, like we're not even talking about general instructions for Israel yet, because Israel doesn't exist. Okay. So that's all the biblical, where we fall in the biblical narrative. The genre of the book is family story. Everything up to Genesis 11 is kind of, this is a scary word, I know. I don't mean all the baggage with it, but everything up to Genesis 11 is kind of what we could fairly call mythology. I don't mean by that that it's not true or that it didn't happen. I mean that the stories, the way they're told, is they're epic stories about origins. Where do we come from? Who are we? What are we about? Everything up to the Tower of Babel is that kind of story. But then you get into the story of Abraham, and now we're in family history. We're talking about who this family is, and why does that matter in the overall flow of the biblical narrative? Why do we have family stories for Abraham's family?
That's who God used.
That's the family God used, but for what? To establish his people, they become the people of Israel, and the people of Israel...
Promise.
The promise, which gets us to Jesus, right? So the whole family story is heading somewhere. This isn't just recollections and reminiscing. This whole thing is taking us in a direction. And so when we get to the story of Abraham, we're starting the foundation of our family story. You know, this is like your grandma talking about when great-great-great-great-grandpa Gottlieb came over on the boat and, you know, bought a piece of land in Minnesota that was just like Poland, and, you know, like that's what this is. This is the family stories. Where do we come from? Who are we? Okay, so the book itself, Genesis, remember the internal culture, external culture distinction that we're talking about.
What's the last pre there, Mark? Pre-Israel, pre...
Ten Commandments. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, that's all the kind of pre-law conversation. Okay, so the book itself, Genesis... okay, so the traditional view of Genesis is that Moses wrote it. That's why we call the Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy the five books of Moses. The Jewish people call that the Torah, the Pentateuch. It's also called the Masoretic text because supposedly it's coming from Moses. Okay, so here's the thing. If Moses wrote it, it was a major divine thing, because the events in this story happened 550 years before Moses was born. And so in a world where people live to 30, that's something on the order of 15 to 20 generations, depending on how you count generations. So if Moses wrote this part of Genesis, at the very best, he's collecting already existing ancient oral stories, very ancient. 550 years ancient oral stories, at the very best. Unless God, you know, beamed the story into his brain, right? But he's certainly not writing this as an eyewitness in the sense that we think. He's not writing this as a biography that he researched. That doesn't exist. So if Moses didn't write it, we don't have any idea who wrote it. The passages that what we have basically were collected in two times. The old part of the Old Testament was collected under the rule of David and Solomon via the priesthood. So the priests began gathering the sacred text together, putting all that into a form. Then, like we talked about last week, all of that was gathered together again and recompiled with the prophets in Babylon when the Jews were in exile and they were trying to reform and protect their sense of identity and their culture. And so both of those are moments of identity forming. The priests are gathering the scripture under David. Why? Because you have a new kingdom. And what's one of the purposes of a kingdom? A purpose of a kingdom is to band us all together as a group of people under a flag. We have an identity. Well, how do you have a shared identity? Well, we have shared stories. We have shared stories about who we are and where we came from. Oh, and also, if you have a monarchy, one of the things that strengthens a monarchy is sort of knowing where your king came from and what's his family story. And so then that becomes really important. So a lot of this is gathered together and formed by the priests in that time. And then the form that we have, kind of the order of the books and what looks very much like our Old Testament, comes together around 600 during the exile. So that's kind of the external story. External story. So then the internal story, we're talking about Bedouins. So in my mind growing up, I had this picture of sort of the culture being kind of generic Bible people, you know, like that everything I knew about them was what I learned through the Felts, and that's what they were. Right? So the culture of Abraham and Lot, which is the story, the culture of Abraham and Lot is Bedouins. They're nomadic, Middle Eastern tribal people. Everything up to this story is a turning point, but everything up to this story, They live in a wandering tribe with flocks and herds and tents, and that's how they lived, right? One of the things that happens in this story is the distinction between people who choose to live in tents wandering and people who choose to live in cities. That's a new thing in the culture. People who live in cities have different problems and different experiences than people who live in tents and wander. And there might even be some editorialization about that difference in the story. Okay, so that's what's beginning to happen. And so Bedouins, what do we know about them? We're not, you know, ethnic experts or whatever. But what do we know about Bedouins?
They move around.
They're nomadic. They have to take everything with them. So if you're nomadic, everything comes with you. If you're wealthy, your wealth has to move with you. It has to either fit in a box or have legs of its own. Mm-hmm. So your wealth is measured in terms of sheep and cows and camels and wives and children, things that can walk. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else?
You're not getting... people are not dropping by for commerce or visitation or this or that necessarily, like maybe would occur in a city.
Okay, yeah, it's way less frequently. To have a visitor is kind of a big deal. And to have a visitor being a big deal, there's another element that's huge in Bedouin culture that still that we see through the Old Testament and Palestine, ancient Near East cultures, still today, and that is the importance of hospitality. The hosting, the table. If you come to visit me, I'm responsible for you. So you think about a Bedouin, so a wealthy Bedouin, a wealthy Arab who's nomadic. If they're wealthy, they've got lots of family, they've got lots of animals. And so if they are nomadic, that's all kind of a camp that travels. And so you can think about that as a domain. Right? So you've got a bunch of tents, you've got herders, you've got animals, you've got people. And the sheik, who that all belongs to, that's his domain, all that stuff. Those people are his people, those animals are his animals, the tents are his tents. If you come to visit him, you're coming to his domain. You're coming under his authority and his protection into his space. And when he picks up and moves somewhere else, that all goes with, right? He's not thinking about the geography being his, he's thinking about all that stuff being his. And so coming into the tent was a pretty big deal. This is my safe place. I'm inviting you in. And so there's this cultural background of hospitality being both a gift that you give someone and a responsibility that you have, right? Because if everybody is nomadic and you are wandering and you come upon a nomadic camp, chances are pretty high that that camp is there because that's where the water is or that's where the shade is. And you've been traveling, which means you've been where that stuff isn't. And so you're not safe on your own out there in the wilderness. And so now that you've come into my camp, not only is it a privilege for me to provide for you, but it's also now my responsibility to keep you safe. So if you're with me, if you're in my domain, if you're with my people, it's my responsibility as the sheikh to keep you safe. And that's something that we still see in Middle Eastern cultures today, that table hospitality is really, really important. Okay, so filtering all that, let's read the story. Genesis 19. Grab a Bible if you don't have one. Okay, everybody there? Okay, Genesis 19. So Genesis 19 starts with this right here. The two angels entered Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting at Sodom's gate. All of a sudden, what you need to say to yourself is, we're in the middle of an action scene. How did we get here? Right? So then you back up. Okay, so the story in Genesis 19 actually begins in Genesis 18. So we go back to the beginning of Genesis 18, okay? So beginning of Genesis 18, we're just going to scan it. I'll kind of highlight, but just follow along in 18:1. So Abraham is in his area, his domain of tents. The Lord appears to Abraham. That's not like a divine visitation, like, right? somebody walks up to Abraham. At the Oaks of Mamre, while he's sitting in the entrance of his tent during the heat of the day. He looks up, he sees three men standing near him. So these three men come. What does Abraham do? He runs from his tent to meet them. He bows to the ground. He says, "My Lord," that does not necessarily mean, "Hey, I see that you are God." When he says, "My Lord," there, that word "Lord" is just a honorific, which he could use for anybody, right? So maybe he knows that it's God, but maybe he doesn't. So somebody walks up, he rushes up and he says, "My Lord, if I found favor in your sight, don't go on past. Stay, let a little water be brought for you. Let me wash your feet, rest yourself under this tree. Let me bring you some bread so you can strengthen yourself. When you've passed your servant's way later, you can continue on." So that's all that initial hospitality thing, right? When he says, "Come rest under this tree," what he's probably saying is, there's not other trees around. Like, the tree is right here because I picked this spot for my tents because this was the awesome spot with shade. And so you're wandering in, have rest under my tree. Let me get you some water. Let me get you some food. Let me clean you up, right? So that's that hospitality thing. So they say, yeah, go ahead and do that. So Abraham hurries into the tent. He tells his wife, "Quick, make some bread." He goes back and he tells someone to cook up a calf, does all of that stuff. There, we have this little intermediate section, which we're going to skip over, verse 9 to 15. That's the whole sequence where Sarah listens in and laughs about the prophecy that she's going to bear a child. That all happens here. Then down to 16, the men get up, they've been refreshed. So they've had their they've had their beef brisket or whatever, and they've had their glass of water and their feet have been washed and they're about to leave. And then the Lord says, maybe kind of verbally so that Abraham overhears, "Should I hide what I'm about to do from Abraham? Abraham is to become a great and powerful nation. All nations of the world will be blessed through him. I've chosen him so that he will command his children in his house." So he sounds like he's thinking about, should I share my plans with Abraham? And this is what his plans are about. Verse 20, the Lord said, "The outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is immense. Their sin is extremely serious." Now, up till now, we don't have really much telling us what that specifically means. Just outcry. There's been a lot of customer service complaints. Serious enough sin, God's coming to investigate. I'm going to go down to see if what they've done justifies the cry that's come up to me. So they head off towards Sodom, and Abraham interrupts, and now we have this fascinating little passage that we're going to skip through, where Abraham sort of negotiates with God, right? Abraham negotiates with him. "Hey, will you really destroy the whole city if you find this many righteous people?" Now, at that point in the story, you should say, why on earth would Abraham care about who is in Sodom? Which means that we have to back up again and find out that the story in Genesis 19 actually starts in Genesis 13. So flip back to Genesis 13. Why does Abraham care about who's in Sodom? So, Genesis 13, this is shortly after Abraham comes into the land. So you remember the very beginning of Abraham's story is Abraham leaves Ur, goes to, quote unquote, the place God will show him. God's leading him to this promised place. Okay, so this is shortly after Abraham arrives. Genesis 13, 1. So Abraham goes up from Egypt to the Negev. He, his wife, all he has in Lot with him. That's the Bedouin society moving. Abraham's very rich in livestock, silver, and gold. He went by stages from the Negev to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai, and it locates these different places. So now what happens is we get to verse 5. Now Lot, this is Abraham's nephew, is that right?
I think so.
Cousin, nephew, a relative, close relative that he's kind of being the guardian of. Now Lot, who is traveling with Abraham, also had flocks and herds and tents. So now you don't just have Abraham the sheikh with his own collection of wealth that belongs to him. You've got this other guy who has become an adult and now has his own collection, and they're all traveling together. But the land was unable to support them as long as they stayed together. Now, why is that? Back to that Bedouin picture. They're traveling through a desolate land. There's not lots of greenery. There's not lots of water. And if Abraham's really wealthy, what does that mean? He's going to take up a lot of space because he's got lots of things that can walk. He's got lots of animals and people that are all his. And so he's going to take up a certain amount of area to support them all. And so now Lot has some of that. And so they're having conflict. So the land was unable to support them as long as they stayed together, for they had so many possessions they could not stay together. there was quarreling between the herdsmen of Abraham's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So Abraham says to him, verse 8, let's not quarrel between you and me. We're family. Let's not quarrel between our servants since we're relatives. Isn't the whole land before you? Separate from me. And then Abraham gives Lot the choice. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. So let's spread out. The land is not strong enough to support everything that we have. Let's spread out more. You pick a direction. Lot looks around at the whole Jordan Valley. So now this is Lot looking at the promised land. As far as Zoar, where was well watered everywhere like the Lord's garden, the land of Egypt. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So there's a little reference to where we're headed. Lot chose the entire Jordan Valley, that's Israel proper, Lot chose the entire Jordan Valley for himself. The text doesn't get into any, like, comment on that choice, you know, other than just presenting it. Abraham said, you choose, I'll go where you want, wherever. Now, Lot just chose what God's promised to Abraham. I don't know if that's relevant or not, but just something interesting to consider. God's promised this to Abraham. Lot chose it. So Lot chose the entire Jordan Valley for himself. Lot journeyed eastward. They separated from each other. So they're separating enough so that there's enough fertile land to support each of their little Bedouin domains. Okay? So now this begins to set up what's going to happen in the story of Sodom. Because verse 12, Abraham lived in the land of Canaan, but Lot lived in the cities of the valley and set up his tent near Sodom. Okay, so Abraham is still living in the less populous, more wild land. Lot goes and moves in right next to the city. He sets up his tent. By the time we get to 13, he's not living in his tent anymore. Or by the time we get to 18, he's not living in his tent anymore. He's living in the city. He actually, we find him in the beginning of 19, sitting at the city gate. Okay, so sitting at the city gate is what somebody does who is a leader or an elder of the town. So he's moved from this Bedouin lifestyle where it's all self-supporting. He's moved into the city. Okay, so then it says right here, verse 13, now the men of Sodom were evil, sinning greatly before the Lord. Doesn't tell us what that is. So then a whole bunch of other stuff happens. Abraham, there's a military thing. Abraham does this cool action movie scene where he winds up his soldiers and they go off and they rescue from this raid. There's another covenant moment between God and Abraham. Hagar and Ishmael, that whole crisis happens. Abraham circumcises himself and all of his male servants. All that stuff happens. Quite a lot happens. And then we get back to where we were. So back now, Abraham's arguing with God about whether God is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. That's why he cares. Yeah.
I don't know why or if this matters, but did Lot know that God had promised this to Abraham?
I don't know. That's a good question.
It seems like that, in my mind, changes his choice. If mm-hmm. he already thinks. I look and it's like, maybe he was there, maybe not.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how old Lot was. And Lot is part of Abraham's family,
right.
You know, so the promise was Abraham and his family. So I don't know how relevant that is.
At least it's self-serving.
But yes, it's right. He picks the very best part of the land for himself.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's something. Okay, so by the time we get to Genesis 18, 26 to 32, where Abraham's having this incredible conversation with God. If I find 50 righteous people in the city, will you destroy it? Well, what about 45? Well, what about 40? Like this crazy negotiating with God thing. And not just negotiating like with God to get good stuff, like negotiating with God on a like terrible judgment that's about to happen. You know, people are going to be killed. So he has this whole conversation. Abraham cares about this because his family lives in Sodom. Right? His family, Lot, and their family, they all have moved down there. Okay, so he has this negotiation with God. We get to the end of 18, and the Lord finishes the negotiation and departs, and Abraham goes back to his place. So now we come to the actual story. Everything we just sort of scanned through is the necessary background to getting us to this moment. This doesn't happen in a vacuum, okay? So Genesis 19. Two angels enter Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting at Sodom's gate. When Lot saw them, he got up to meet them. That's that hospitality thing again, the same practice that we saw with Abraham at the tent. He sees a stranger. Hey, come, let me take care of you. Let me give you rest. Let me get you refreshment. Come to my house. And they say, no, it's fine. We'll just spend the night in the square. And then we get this additional energy that he really wants them to come stay at his house rather than staying in the square. Prepares a feast for them. So verse 4, before they go to bed, the men of the city of Sodom, both young and old, the whole population, surround the house. They call out to Lot and say, where are the men who came to you tonight? Send them out to us so we can have sex with them. Lot goes out to the entrance and shuts the door behind him. He says, don't do this evil, my brothers. Look, I have two daughters who haven't had sexual relations with a man. How about I bring them out to you, and you can do whatever you want to them. However, don't do anything to these men, because they have come under the protection of my roof. Let's talk about those two verses.
Two of my favorite.
Okay? So the very first thing that we do is we read these through the lens of our culture, and they are horrific. Don't set that aside. I don't want you to lose the intuition that they're horrific. But for a moment, we have to do this. We have to go back through and read this verse in light of the place and time and moment. What is happening here? He says, don't do this evil, my brother. Look, I've got two daughters who haven't had sexual relations with a man. I'll bring them out to you. You can do whatever you want. However, don't do anything to these men because they've come under the protection of my roof. Make the assumption that Lot is not a horrific evil man. Make the assumption that Lot is trying to do, as he understands it, the right thing. Now, if you make that assumption for a moment, just for argument's sake, what flows from that? How is it that this act could be, in Lot's mind, the right thing?
It's the lesser of two evils, for sure. In that the hospitality, he has a responsibility to these visitors to protect them, to that their experience be positive.
Okay, so yes, yes and. So the hospitality responsibility is enormous. Your credibility, your authority, even some sense of your power is demonstrated by your capacity to give hospitality in Bedouin culture. Okay? So if they get hurt while they're his guests, that is shame to him. Now the and is, but wait a minute, his daughters are his daughters. If his daughters get hurt, isn't that bad? Well, how is it that that can be the lesser of two evils?
Well, in the culture, again, we're talking about kind of this hierarchy, and it would seem that visitors would fall higher on the hierarchy than women.
Especially male.
Not any visitor.
Yeah,
male visitors would fall higher on the hierarchy than women, right? Mm-hmm. For bad things to happen to women, well, that's just normal. That's what happens in this world. But for bad things to happen to a male guest that I've promised hospitality and protection to, mm-hmm. that's bad to them and shame to me. Right? Okay. So Lot, that's his response. The crowd's outside pounding on the door. Send out those guys so that we can have sex with them. Right? He says, don't do that. It's evil. We're like, yeah, that totally makes sense, Lot. It is evil. And Lot says, here, let me give you my daughters instead. Then they say, now this is important, get out of the way, they added. This one came here as a foreigner, but he's acting like a judge. Now we'll do more harm to you than to them. Okay, so what does that tell us about what they were coming here for?
Harm.
They're coming to do harm. Which means they're not coming for just sexual pleasure, right? They're not like, oh wow, there were some hot guys in the square today. You know, let's enjoy some time with them. Like, that's not what this is about. They're coming to do harm.
When you say this fellow came here, they mean Lot?
They mean Lot, right. Yeah. So
it
Lot,
sounds like they're coming after Lot in some ways. He came here as an alien and he now wants to be a judge. Like they don't like his power structure?
Maybe. At the very least, him telling them to not to not rape these guys, he's saying, don't do that, that's evil. And they're saying, well, who are you to tell us anything?
Right?
You know, we're going to just do the same thing to you. Okay, so what is it that they're doing? Like a whole big crowd. This isn't like a single person hiding in the bushes jumping out to rape somebody. This is a whole big crowd of people coming in to do this harm. Do you have any insight, any clue about what is happening there?
Well, I don't know if this applies, but we talk in the therapeutic field as sexual abuse or sexual assault is the sexual expression of aggression. That is, it's an angry act. It's mm-hmm. that the primary motive isn't necessarily sexual satisfaction. It is about humiliation, power, control, those kind of things. That seems to kind of fit for this.
Right. So some strangers come to town, and they want to haul those strangers out and make a point,
yeah.
right? And we can see a little more clearly that that's so because of Lot's response. Right? When Lot gives them a perfectly culturally acceptable sexual outlet, they say, that's not what we're here for.
Mm-hmm.
Don't judge us. We're here to do something else.
So it says at the beginning, two angels.
Mm-hmm.
Did Lot know that they were angels?
I don't know. That's a great question.
Because if they, the townspeople that are there, know that they're angels, then it might be a show of dominance. Higher than
sure, it's a show angels. Of dominance in any case. But if they knew they were angels, then yeah, it's a like a religious show of dominance.
Yeah.
You know, like we're even more powerful than your God, which could certainly be part of the story for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the text tells us if they knew or not, or even if Lot knew. He's just treating them as strangers, but it could be. And that question of the idea of having sex with angels actually comes up later in Jude commenting on this passage. So something's going on here, and whatever it is, at this point, without looking at anything else, we can already say this is not about homosexual same-sex attraction. This is not about somebody violating a specific kind of sexual act. Even if there was a standard, which we have no biblical standard yet, there is no biblical standard yet of what sex acts are okay, but clearly something is happening in the passage that's not acceptable. But what's happening in the passage that's not acceptable, when we look at the context, Lot goes out and welcomes them in under his roof. That's the first thing he does. That mirrors, it's exactly the same language as what happens back at the beginning of 18 when Abraham gets up from his tree and goes out to the guests and says, come, let me. He does exactly the same thing, same language, right? And that's that hospitality invitation. Come, let me take care of you. Come under my protection. And so when Lot says, hey, you guys, what you're doing is evil, there's some likelihood that what he's talking about is that violation. He's not talking about, you know, you guys are flaunting a sexual behavior that I don't approve of and it's around my house. Don't do it around here. Like what he's saying is evil is these people are about to violate the covenant of hospitality that he has said, this is my house. Now the problem, one of the sort of city tent problems is that Abraham, because it's his dominion, can enforce that. Lot lives in the city, and the city is not Lot's dominion. The city is a collaborative living place where lots of people live close to each other. And so Lot doesn't actually have the power or maybe the right, they're saying. Like the other people are saying, who are you to judge us this way? Right? So they're maybe saying, you don't even have the power to do this. So your choice to protect these guys isn't up to you. So there's a contrast that's going on there.
At the risk of throwing a wrench in this, what do we do with the fact that what is clear in the text is that they're going to be, that these males want to have sex with males? Now, again, if that's a violent act, that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what's clear is we want to have sex with them.
Right, and here's a question that we're going to look at some other passages, so there's more information to unfold. But right at this moment, here's a question that's on my mind, if we just take what we have.
Mm-hmm.
Is the we want to have sex with them the story or ancillary to the story? Like, is the story we want to do violence to them, and the kind of violence we're choosing is to degrade them sexually?
Right.
Because in our culture, we're going to make them like women and slaves. We're going to let them know, like you said, we're powerful. This is our town. We can do whatever the heck we want to do here. It's our place.
Yeah.
And you just need to know that. If you're going to come in here, maybe they're spies. from some other kingdom, from some other city, and they're coming to check us out. Well, we're going to show you. Walk into our city. This is what you get, right? So is the story, we're going to do violence to these people, and we're going to choose a particularly degrading kind of violence? Or is the story, we're men, they're men, there's going to be a sex act involved? I'm unclear about that from what the text says so far.
Or is it even a sign of the spiritual or the religious active of the city? Is the sex act of religious putting them under their religion, under their rule? I'm not familiar with all the religions that were, but it seemed like those kinds of things were very popular in the type of worship of certain gods.
Yeah, we don't know, but that's not crazy to suggest. I mean, it's hard for us to keep in mind that in ancient times, the very beginning of our concept, the very seed of the secular concept, I'm not going to say this is God's plan, but the sort of secular concept of marriage, the seed was, the way you got married was you had sex with somebody, right? That you dominated them, right? And so then we sort of took the consummation night as something that happens after they're legally married. But actually, in ancient times, the way you made someone your wife was you just went and had sex with them, and now they belong to you, right? There's times in the Old Testament where people are told, you know, go off into this city and take wives for yourselves. Okay, they're not being told to go off and propose and get fiancés and plan a wedding. Like, they're being told to go by force into a town and kidnap girls and have sex with them, which makes them their wives. So that idea that they're sort of expressing dominance is not just like we're stronger than you, but like we own you. You belong to us. So that's not a crazy idea to suggest either.
And again, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to make sure I clear my mind. We don't know. There's no law about what is right sexually at this stage.
We don't know. Right? The only sex-specific command up to this point in the Bible is procreate.
So we don't know that even if they are going to have sex with males, that's not established as wrong.
No, but here's what we do know that I still got to figure out, and that is the Lord said the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin is so grievous that I will go down and see what they have done as bad as the outcry has reached me.
Okay? Yeah. Yes.
That happens before, obviously, chapter 19.
Yeah, that's 13.
Yeah.
So something is awry, for sure.
Right. And so then the question, you know, one interpretation of that is, well, men are sleeping with men. I mean, that's kind of that traditional.
Right. And that's a fair thing to say, as long as you acknowledge that there is nothing in the text up to this point that says that's the case.
Right.
The only thing the text says is there's very grave sin in Sodom. God's coming down to check it out.
Right.
But it doesn't tell us to say that the sin God's coming to check out is that Sodom was full of homosexuals is to read back into the text.
Absolutely.
An interpretation we already have at the end. Now, maybe that interpretation is right, but you can't honestly say that's coming from this part of the scripture.
Right, but the dilemma is that if it's not that, then the question follows, okay, what is it?
Right.
If they were involved in some kind of grievous sin, what was that? Now, again, the other side of that argument could be they were really mean and violent and inhospitable. That might, okay. But they're doing something.
Right. No question.
Yeah.
Something that draws God's attention, something that ultimately brings about the first and most profound judgment in the Bible.
Yeah.
Wiping this people off the map.
Yeah.
So there's a big deal going on here. Mm-hmm. We just have to be careful as Bible readers to make sure when we're reading the Bible, we're not just automatically filling in the blanks with things we think we already know.
Right?
We have to go back and query it and say, where is that idea coming from? And this is particularly difficult on this passage because the very word that is the name of the city already has a full backpack of meaning. Right? And so when we say the town of Sodom, everybody automatically already has a story in their head about what was up with Sodom. But you have to understand that that idea, what was up with Sodom, is an idea that was developed in the 5th century. It doesn't exist in the early church fathers in the 1st and 2nd centuries. It doesn't exist in the New Testament in a clear-as-day way. It's a development. Now, we live on the other side of that development, so it's automatic to us. But we have to ask the question, where is this coming from?
It's so interesting, too, when you think about if the story simply were, we're going to come in and we're going to rape a bunch of women, we're going to take all those women, then we would be just like, oh, that's rape. That's heinous. Because mm-hmm. that's how we understand. But if you think, they wouldn't tell the story that way because women didn't matter.
Okay, so just know, you just did a thing in my brain. Because we go back to 13, Genesis 13. We skipped a section that's exactly that. We skipped a section in Genesis 14. So Abraham, they're living in Mamre, and there's a bunch of kings. And these kings all get together, and they come, and they raid, and they take the women. They come, and they take the women and the families, and they go. That's all the beginning of 14.
The four kings seized all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food. Carried off Abraham's nephew Lot and possessions.
We have a lot of really horrible things happening.
Like, right. So, but when it says all his possessions, what does that mean?
His women.
That means all the things that can walk, right? His women, his children, his animals, all that stuff.
16, he recovered all the goods and brought back his possessions together with the women and other people.
Okay. So in that scenario, there's a group of people who come in and they do exactly what you said. They come in and they take the people, they take the women, which taking the women meant taking them for your belonging, and taking them for your belonging means you get to have sex with them, right? So they take the women, and Abraham gets his guys together and goes after them on this raid and rescues back the people. And so that's an actual example of the thing you're talking about, and that's not God's not interacting in this passage about it. Like, the interaction with God is actually this whole weird tithing thing that Abraham does, where Abraham recovers everything and the kings say, you know, thank you for doing that, you can have all the goods, and just give us back our people. And Abraham says, no, I don't want that stuff. I just want my people, and, you know, you can give a tithe. And so that's happening here in the context of this larger story. And God's not coming in specifically about that, unless that's tied into this later, you know, sin.
It seems to me that these men, they didn't want the daughters. What they really wanted is, they said, get out of our way. And this fellow came here as an alien. It sounds to me like there's a resentment, and it might be that Lot was part of Abraham's family, which mm-hmm. Abraham was a, you know, important person.
And a foreigner.
Yeah, and a foreigner. And then they kept pressuring Lot and broke down the door of his house. They reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door, and they struck the men who were at the door of the house. So they were doing some violent break-in mm-hmm. into Lot's home. Mm-hmm. And so it's more like, seems more like to me that they were after Lot for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that makes sense too, because if Lot is taking these men under his authority for protection, then doing damage to them would be an attack on him. An attack on his credibility, an attack on his honor, right? And we know that the honor and shame thing is super important. That's the only reason why he can justify saying, take my daughters instead of these men, right? Because it's not a reflection on Lot's honor to have his daughters raped. It is a reflection on Lot's honor to have his guests hurt or done damage to. So you may be very right about that. Abraham comes in. He's very wealthy. He's got lots of stuff. Lot comes in. You know, they're kind of up on the hill outside the city. There could be some of that resentment. You know, that definitely comes out. You know, you came here as an alien. You know, you wonder if there's a little sort of ethnic hatred or It's not really national hatred because there's not a nation yet.
It certainly doesn't seem in my mind that Lot had any love and concern for his daughters, that he was willing to do this to them. I mean, what was with this guy? He didn't show love and so on for his immediate family.
Oh, totally. I completely resonate with that. But you just have
good
to
stuff.
But you just have to recognize that.
Right.
And I think that we have the right to say that, and we have the right to critique the story that way. But in understanding what's happening, right, he is not in his own understanding being right. evil. Yeah. He is in his own understanding trying to prevent evil, which makes no sense to us. Right? And if this is why, this is exactly the reason why it is deep weeds to try and take something in the ancient Old Testament and make it a rule for today. Because the ancient Old Testament's cultural expectation and understanding is not only not ours, it is not the expectation and understanding of Jesus.
Well, and thank God, because who wants to give up their daughters for the sake of
right.
men?
Right. And so that critique is absolutely a fair one. And so when people come back to this text and say, this text says something about how we should live today in regard to gay people, that criticism is actually one of the first that undermines the whole story. Wait a minute. This text doesn't say anything about how we should take care of women. This text doesn't say anything helpful about how we should take care of daughters or family. How can you say that this text says how we should treat gay people? Right? You can't just pick one and say, you know. But Jeff, I think Jeff wanted to say something about it. Yeah.
So let's say this might be what God is sending the angels for, you know, that we, or that they as a society, would see nothing wrong with offering the women or their daughters up as sacrifice for something so bad, that might be the thing. One of the things, in addition, you know, just how the society views the hierarchy.
Well, I think for sure, because like even if you take that the highest value that's at play in this story is the commitment of hospitality, even if you take that, this culture has a long ways to go to where hospitality includes women and children.
Is that
yeah, so there's a long kind of ethnic road to go, or ethical road, not ethnic. Yeah. There's a long ethical road to go before you and I could say, well, if I have a responsibility for hospitality, it includes my loved ones, it includes my women and children, you know, living within that, we've got quite a ways to go before the text of the scripture shows somebody raising their hand and saying, yes, we should also protect the women, the widows, the powerless.
That would make sense until you read the next few verses, because then the two angels say to Lot, who else do you have here? Get out of here, because we're going to destroy the city. So Lot was the person who offered his daughters. So if that was one of the problems that God saw, you'd think the angels would keep Lot there, because Lot's part of the problem. But the angels wanted to save Lot and said...
And his wife and children.
Yeah, and his wife and children. Get out of here.
Yeah.
But Lot was the one that offered his daughters.
Right.
How did it come to be that women were thought of in that way? That they weren't, that they didn't mean anything? Does it come from the story of Adam and Eve and what happened there? And how many women were viewed after that or what?
I, that is a giant, deep question. I mean, my short answer is I think that one of the immediate consequences of sin is that you believe that you have the right to take what you're powerful enough to take. And because just genetically women are more vulnerable than men, I mean, if you're bearing a child, no matter how strong of a person you are, if you are bearing a child, you're more vulnerable while that child is in you. You know, men were stronger. And I think that in that sinful place, you feel like might makes right. And I don't know that that's the answer, but certainly put this book away. Put this book away and just look at human history. That is almost the universal consensus of ancient culture.
Yeah.
almost every ancient culture has that same hierarchy of women at the bottom, you know.
Well, women were like possessions.
Yeah.
Even today, some men think women are their possessions.
Right. I enjoy when I get to officiate weddings, I enjoy pointing out to people that on the Oregon wedding license, the actual legal document that marries you, just above the spot where you sign your name, there's a tiny small print section that just says, I don't remember the exact wording, but basically says, as a result of this, neither of you belong to the other person, and both of you have the right to live in physical safety. There's a little line just above where you sign. Well, it's crazy that that is on the wedding license, but that's on the wedding license because it's a problem, you know? Yeah. Okay. So we're done with our time. Obviously, we're not done with this conversation. So what we're going to do next week is we are going